Once again, yeah, Tim said my name is Dave, and I am a bit taller than he is. And I am the lead deacon here at Koinos, and among other things that I help with, and sometimes I get to come up and talk. And that is a clip from the movie Jaws, which I remember when I used to watch this movie as a kid with my dad, he would always point out that the shark is not real. The shark's not real, you know. And I was like, yes, Dad, they did not actually get a real-life shark to actually eat people. It's not a documentary. But I hope he's not visiting or listening to the podcast, but I love you, Dad, if you are. So this movie came out in 1975, quite a while ago, and it changed the way the film industry forever. It was the first what we could call summer blockbuster, and it was the first movie to make more than $100 million. If you know anything about movies nowadays, every movie, we have two or three summer blockbusters each week. And if they don't make at least $100 million in the first weekend, they're considered a failure. But beyond all that, this movie also scared a lot of people. I mean, who can watch a movie about a man-eating shark then just like leave the theater and go to the beach and swim out beyond the waves and not at least think about what is lurking in the murky depths beneath you? And from the tagline of the sequel, because they made a few sequels, Jaws 2, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, to Shark Week, which I think might still be a thing, our irrational fear of sharks or maybe the creatures that lurk in the mysterious dark places of this world has stayed with us. And I'm sure some of us rational folks would be like, you know, statistically, you're not really likely to be eaten by a shark. It happens very rarely. But again, like, we can know that rationally, but you can't tell me that when you watch this movie and then go swimming in the ocean, it doesn't at least cross your mind. And I think the reason why those ideas come into our heart or our minds is that Jaws taps into something deep in our psyche and in our history as people. Water, oceans, storms, these are long a symbol of chaos across cultures and throughout all of human history. We just look at the beginning of the Bible, the beginning of the Christian scriptures, when God creates the universe. And we read of God separating the water from the land. But what's going on here is something much more deeper than simply God pushing some water around and making some islands. Because in the ancient world, again, water was a symbol of chaos, of danger, and lots of cultures had stories of gods, or in the Christian scriptures, the one God, having to wrestle and push and overcome this watery, scary, terrifying chaos to bring some sort of peace and order into existence. If you know the Bible story, you know that it's only a couple of chapters later, Noah's Ark, maybe you've been around church, you've been in Sunday school, Noah's Ark, the flood, when God kind of steps back, removes his protecting hand, and the waters of chaos return to cover all of creation. And again, I'm fascinated by the fact that across cultures, across the world, there's dozens and dozens of stories of floods that echo that story of Noah. Again, it's as if there's something deep in us has this fear that chaos in the form of water and storms is going to come back and press against us. So we think further on this, is it any wonder that so many cultures throughout history have had a belief in some sort of god of the sea? Maybe when you were in school, you remember reading or you've seen a movie adaptation of the story of Ulysses and the Trojan War, the god Poseidon, Greek mythology, hopefully you remember that. Basically, it was this story from long ago where the Greek armies went to the city of Troy and they fought in this war that lasted decades. Finally, a man named Ulysses had the idea of the Trojan horse, and that helped them to win the war. After the war was won, Ulysses failed, though, to offer a sacrifice or a gift to the god Poseidon, the god of the sea, who had really been helping the Greeks. And because of this slight, Poseidon determined that Ulysses would never make it home. So when Ulysses got on his boat, took to the sea to travel back to Greece, Poseidon sent storms. Poseidon, there was monsters, the Cyclops. There's all this terror happening to keep Ulysses from getting home. So if you're living in the ancient world and you're surrounded by the mystery of the sea, and this can extend to the dark, deep forests, high, terrifying mountains, when you venture into these places of chaos, you need help. An amulet, a talisman, a magic sword, the blessing of a god. Something to keep you safe when you go into the mystery. And when you survive and you come through on the other side safely, you need to then give thanks, an offering, or worship to what you believe has led you through safely. Well, this morning we are continuing the series titled Radical. Tim has told us in the last couple of weeks that the word radical comes from the Latin word for root. So we are examining different practices that root us as people of faith. And this morning I am, if you haven't figured it out already, talking about worship. Again, throughout human history, people, humans, have worshipped gods or the one, kind of one god that we believe have brought us safely through the waters. The prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, Isaiah chapter 43, verse 2, Isaiah wrote, although it is God speaking, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. When you pass through the water, I will be with you." Over and over and over again, if you know the Bible, we see this over and again, constantly throughout the scriptures. There's a part of the Bible where God's people, the Israelites, are enslaved in Egypt. And they are freed from Egypt, and they leave, and they start traveling, and they come to the Red Sea. The Egyptians decide they want their slaves back. They go to chase them, and the Israelites are trapped. How are they going to survive? God miraculously comes down, story goes, parts the water so they can go safely through to the other side. "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you." Later on, God's people, when they were living in their own country and trying to stay true to God, they were faced with the temptation to worship other lesser gods, idols, things like that. One of the primary competitors for their allegiance was a god named Baal or Baal, who was the god, it was believed, of storms. Who is the one who brings you safely through the water? There's another story of a man named Jonah, Jonah and the whale. Maybe you've heard of this one, where Jonah is asked or told by God to go do something. Jonah says, "I don't want to do that. I'm going to go over here." He gets on a boat, leaves. A storm comes, and every single person on that boat, regardless of their religious beliefs, they are like, this storm is clearly being sent by some god who is angry at somebody on this boat, because storms are chaos. And what can we do then to bring peace? We come to Jesus, who Christians believe is God's revelation, God among us. And what is one of the ways that Jesus demonstrates that he is God among us, that he has a power over nature? He also is on a boat. There is also a storm at one point, and he calms the storm. Like God in the beginning of creation, bringing order out of chaos, pushing back the waves, Jesus does the same. And we could carry this the whole way to the very last couple chapters of the entire Bible in the book of Revelation, when there's this picture of the future that I think we all could hope for, where there's no more evil and there's no more suffering and there's no more death and peace has come. And there's one verse in there that says, "And there is no more sea." Because what cannot exist anymore when there's no more suffering? What cannot exist when peace has fully arrived? The watery chaos of the ocean depths. At the same time, we modern people living in the year 2018, we've moved past this, right? We've sent submarines to the depths. We know that the Jaws isn't going to eat us. We've climbed the highest mountain. We've gone into the forest. We fly across continents, and we don't give a second thought to the ocean 30,000 feet below our plane. Or if we're adventurous people and we want to hike up a mountain or do something crazy, go into what our ancestors would have been terrified to go into, we have GPS. If we need help, we have a phone. We think that maybe we pushed back some of that chaos, right? But at the same time, there are moments when the chaos presses in upon us. When Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy bears down upon different cities and we have to batten down the hatches, we're reminded that nature and chaos is still there, and perhaps we're still a bit vulnerable. Or just look at that story recently of the 12 boys in Thailand who were stuck in that cave. I'm sure you all heard that fantastic rescue and how they all and their coach made it out alive. But how'd the story go? They went out into nature, went into this cave, the waters rise up, and all of a sudden they're trapped. Or another story I read of a woman in Australia who, for some reason, thought it would be a good idea to feed a shark with her bare hands. I guess she hasn't seen Jaws. And the shark, like, grabbed her hand and dragged her into the water towards where a bunch of crocodiles were living. So I read that and I thought, if the crocodiles and the sharks are, like, teaming up, we're in trouble. Thankfully, she didn't die. I wouldn't share it. Like, it turned out okay. She's fine. But again, we may think that we are kind of separated from some of these things that our ancestors would have seen as terrifying, mysterious, or chaotic. But there's moments when that chaos presses in upon us. And apart from the literal storms, of course, and the actual literal nature, we can look at it on a more metaphorical level. And we all face storms in life. The loss of loved ones, loss of jobs, broken relationships, other things that, again, just press in upon us like storms. When we survive those storms, when we come out safe through or safe on the other side, even to us modern people, it may not be surprising then when we turn to worship. Because when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Who will be with us, though? If we go back to the ancient world, I mean, one question we may ask is, okay, so God says I will be with you, but really, I mean, who will be with us? Who is going to keep us safe? And I mentioned that there are other things that are competing for our allegiance. There are other gods or whatever we may have that are trying to say, no, I'll be the one to keep you safe. So let's go back to the time of Jesus once again, because I'm a history nerd and I'm going to hopefully not bore you with a little bit of this. But one of the things I find fascinating, carrying on this water metaphor a bit farther, is Jesus lived in the time of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire controlled the entire Mediterranean Sea from, like, Spain, Italy, the Middle East, North Africa. But there was a time about 100 years before Jesus when pirate bands dominated the ocean. The Romans didn't have a very powerful navy, and the pirates were just multiplying. They were interrupting shipping. They were very powerful. It was getting to the point where the pirates were even starting to attack some of the towns in Italy close to the capital city of Rome. So one of the great Roman generals, Pompey, about 100 years before Jesus, went to the Roman government and said, here's the deal. I'm going to take care of this problem for you. I'm going to get rid of all these pirates. Here's what I need. Here's my plan. He, like, divided the entire Mediterranean Sea into, like, 13 regions, said, we're going to build some ships. We're going to take care of this. And he did. He went out. One historian says that Pompey destroyed 1,300 pirate ships, which means nothing except, let's just say, that's a lot. And he took care of the problem in 89 days, which, again, so you're like, so what? But, like, that was really quickly to get rid of all the pirates in the entire Mediterranean Sea. Some of them started to realize that they were, you know, should probably just surrender instead of fighting the Roman Empire, and they were forgiven. But think about it. If you're living in those days, and you're someone who makes your living transporting goods on the sea, picking up items here, sailing through the ocean here, trading them off, getting new ones, however that works, and you're saying or thinking, who has brought me safely through the waters? Well, the answer is very obvious. Your dad may have been killed by pirates, but you can travel safely because Rome has brought you safely through the waters. This is really illustrated even more deeply than in the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And part of me is a little nervous to like mention the book of Revelation because, again, if you've been around church, even if you haven't, you may hear the book of Revelation, final book of the Bible, and you all think of like judgments and fire and brimstone and destruction and all this weird stuff. I would ask you to forget all that for the next 5 minutes, maybe forever actually, but for the next 5 minutes at least. Because if you actually read the book of Revelation, it's more about worship than it is about judgment. It's really asking the question to people who were being told on a daily basis that there's so many other places to look for safety, that there's so many other gods out there from Rome on down. There's so many other things that have brought you safely through the water. And Revelation was written by a man named John, one of Jesus' disciples, to challenge the early Christians and say, who really has brought you safely through the water? Who are you worshiping? And who should you worship? I'm not going to read Revelation 4 and 5, but if you want to on your own time, it's basically two chapters painting a picture of the throne room of God. And again, it's lots of imagery and it's lots of metaphor and it's weird, but the point of this is that the entire universe is centered on the God who created us and then the God who came to us in the person of Jesus to save us. And everything else is oriented around that. And that's the challenge. Because in those days, the emperor of Rome wanted to be called Lord and God. They wanted your worship. They wanted your sacrifice. They wanted your ultimate allegiance. Rome wanted to be the one through which you oriented your life. And the author of Revelation, John, is saying you need to orient your life around Jesus. And John is painting again, all those images of judgment, that's painting a picture to challenge you to say, the things that you might be tempted to put your worship and faith in, they're not gonna lead you safely through the water. There's even a passage in Revelation 18 where it's a kind of a picture of the fall and destruction of Rome. And in this picture, we have those merchants I mentioned earlier, the people who were able, because Rome had cleansed the sea of pirates, to make a lot of money traveling around, selling and buying. But Revelation 18, verses 11 and then 14 and 15, we have these merchants of the earth who look at what happens to the city of Rome when it falls apart. It says, they weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. They will say, the fruit that you long for is gone from you. All your luxury and splendor have vanished and never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn. When you go through the waters, who are you hoping will be with you? Who will be the one to bring you safely through the storms? Will it be a Rome, or will it be the Lamb who was slain? Now, talking about worship, some of our friends may say that, okay, worship's good for Christians. We're here, what we might call worship service. Maybe people of other religions might worship too. But I know people that would say, like, I don't worship anything. That's just for weak-minded spiritual people, right? I would argue that in reality, everybody worships something. Everybody has something around which we orient everything else in our life. Maybe it's God and Jesus, that throne room imagery. Maybe it's the government. Maybe it's our checkbook. But we all have something that when the waters rise up, we're going to look there. David Foster Wallace was a writer, and he wasn't a Christian, as far as I know. But in one of his speeches, he touched on this. He said, here's something else that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. What do you worship? What do I worship? If I'm honest, the thing that is most important in my life, the thing around which everything else in my life is oriented, that is what I worship. The reformer and pastor Martin Luther, hundreds of years ago, wrote, "Whatever your heart clings to and confides in, that in reality, that is really your God." It makes me think of a compass. If you have a compass, if you're out going into the mysterious, chaotic world to have an adventure, a compass doesn't tell you where to go. A compass simply points north so that you can then understand everything else around you and figure out which way to go. That's kind of how worship is. What is the thing that we are orienting our lives around? What is the thing that we're pointing our compass to so that we know how to live in our day-to-day life? And if we can determine what that is, and even maybe ask our friends who would say they don't worship anything to determine what that is, that's where we find the thing that we worship. At the same time, everybody worships something, right? But what you worship matters. It's not necessarily neutral. If we go back to that passage in the book of Revelation, Rome claimed to be the ultimate authority. They said they were the ones that would bring you safely through the waters. They would point to all kinds of things that they had done in the past for people. They would make promises for what they're going to do in the future. But what the author of John, the author of Revelation, would say is that there's going to come a day when all those things are going to fall apart. They're not going to be there for you when the water of chaos presses in. In his same speech that I mentioned a moment ago, Wallace goes on. He actually touches on this too. He says that that there are some things you worship. He talks about different religions, long traditions that have a little bit more staying power. He says you should put your, go for one of those. Because then he goes on and says, pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. You will never feel you have enough. It's the truth. In other words, maybe if I was going to paraphrase that, some things that we may choose to worship will destroy us. Some things we orient our life around they're not designed for that, and they're going to eat us alive. Or maybe in a simpler way, some things promise to be there when we go through the waters, but they do not help. So if I'm thinking through this, okay, so we all worship something, and not everything we worship is worthy of our worship. So how do we then balance the things in our life? Am I saying that like governments are bad, and money and careers are bad, and family is bad? No. I think the challenge for us would be not to make good things into ultimate things. The problem isn't loving your family or having a career or loving your country or anything like that. Like, those are all good things. Clearly, I think that is true. The problem becomes when we take those good things, which when we're oriented towards proper worship, towards God on the throne, those good things all kind of fall into place around that. The problem becomes if we're tempted to make those good things into ultimate things. If your greatest love, or if the thing we worship, is a lesser good, then it's either going to fail us in our moment of need, or it just might turn around and destroy us. I think there's a C.S. Lewis quote that really helps me understand this, at least. He said, aim for heaven and you get earth, aim for earth and you get neither. I think the point again there is, if we have our worship focused on the one thing that deserves our ultimate allegiance, then everything else will kind of take care of itself. But if we start to take those things of earth and put them in a place they don't belong, they can't carry that weight and they're going to fail. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. some things will always be there for us. One thing will always be there for us. And a whole lot of things will not. From that, one of the things I've seen over and over again as I was preparing for this this morning was this idea that you are what you worship, or you become what you worship, or you are what you love. Everybody worships something, but again, it's not like then it's a neutral choice of just anything is good for you. Some things, it's going to shape us. The things we orient our life around is going to change and affect how we live. The New Testament scholar N.T. Wright has a quote that I really like that helps me understand this. He wrote, "You become like what you worship when you gaze in awe, admiration, and wonder at something or someone. You begin to take on something of the character of the object of your worship." It makes me think of those old pirates again. So one more moment of history nerddom. So there's a story of those ancient Roman pirates who captured a young man named Julius Caesar. Hopefully you know Julius Caesar. Beware the Ides of March. They stabbed him later on. Spoiler alert, sorry. Well, when he was a young man, he was captured by pirates. And he was very wealthy. And what the pirates would do was they would capture these wealthy Roman citizens and they would then ask for a ransom, make some money. Well, Caesar was not afraid of these pirates. He actually was like mocking them. He would tell them that like they're not asking enough because he's worth way more than the ransom that they're asking. And he told them that when the ransom is paid, he's going to leave, he's going to get some ships and come back and like kill them all. Which, again, spoiler alert, that's exactly what happened. He got the ransom. He went off, got some ships, got some sailors, got some weapons, found the pirates that had held him in captivity, and crucified every single one of them. You become what you worship. The way of Rome in Jesus' day, the way of so many of the things in our day, is a sort of peace through violence or vengeance. And if we're orienting our life around something like that, that's going to affect how we live. Am I centering my life on something that is making me a more violent person, or am I centering my life on something that is making me a kinder person? Am I worshiping something that is going to make me more vengeful, or am I worshiping something that's going to make me more forgiving? Am I worshiping something that's going to make me more trustworthy? Or am I worshiping something that's going to make me more of a gossip? And you kind of go right down the line. And as I think about that, and I think about worship, this is why I think it's so important to not think of worship as just what happens here on a Sunday morning. Because if all of my worship, if the only time I'm kind of centering my life on the Lamb that was slain, on Jesus, is here, and the rest of my week I'm listening to the news and going through my life, and there's a lot of other things, some of them good, some of them not, but they're all competing for my allegiance. They're all teaching me something. They're all asking me to worship them. And they're going to shape me. And if I'm shaped for like a couple hours a week around the self-giving love of God, and I'm shaped for 100 hours a week around get ahead, get vengeance, win the game, whatever it might be, that's going to affect the kind of person I am in the long run. So lots of things demand our worship. And the question that I would keep wanting to ask myself is, what sort of person are these things shaping me into? Because in the end, I would say that worship of the Lamb, Jesus, God coming to us, who he is, who we understand him to be, that is what is best for us. And that is also the only thing demanding our worship that is honest with us. A lot of things want us to put worship in them, and they make a lot of promises about who we are and how we're whatever and this and that. But only the Lamb of God, only Jesus, only God on the throne is going to tell us exactly where we belong, who we are. And this is not easy to hear. One more quote I found that I really wanted to share comes from a woman named Marva Dawn. She wrote a book about worship. She talks about how God, she says, God's revelation unmasks our illusions about ourselves. It exposes our pride, our individualism, our self-centeredness, in short, our sin. But worship also offers forgiveness, healing, transformation, motivation, and courage to work in the world for God's justice and peace. In short, salvation in its largest sense. When we pass through the rivers, who will be with us? When we pass through the oceans, when the water rises up and life becomes incredibly challenging, what sort of person are we going to be? How is our worship shaping us? And God's revelation, she says, is going to unmask. It's not easy to be unmasked the truth about yourself, but it's good for us in the end. I want to share two stories that I think illustrate this to me, that illustrate how a life of worship centered on the Lamb has changed people for the better and led to some of the beautiful worship songs that we sing in churches like this one. In the 1700s in England, there was a man named John Newton. He was a slave trader, because slavery was legal then. So he worked on a slaving boat. He nearly lost his life as a young man on a slaving boat. And through this experience, he put his faith in Jesus, became a person of faith, Christian. But he continued to work in slaving, which seems like, how could you do that? You come to faith in Jesus, but you're still going to keep trading humans for money. He later said, I cannot have considered myself to have been a believer in the truest sense of the word. So he committed to worship God and Jesus, but he still was drawn to those other idols. He probably made a good bit of money trading humans. He wanted the comfort that that lifestyle provided. But over time, as I understand it, as he continued to worship, center his life on Jesus, think about what that meant, he came to realize that he was taking part in horrific evil. And he turned away from that. He eventually penned the hymn, Amazing Grace. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. As Dawn mentioned, our worship will reveal our own sin and brokenness. When we worship God, we're going to maybe discover things about ourselves that we don't like very much. And it had to be hard for Mr. Newton to reckon with. So much of his life and choices had harmed other people so deeply. But as he kept on worshiping the Lamb and focused on the one thing that made sense to orient his life around, he was changed and transformed. Another story of another hymn is a man named Horatio Spafford. He was an American lawyer and businessman in the 1870s. In 1873, his wife and four daughters got on a ship to travel to Europe. The ship collided with another ship and sank. His four daughters died. His wife was saved by a rescue vessel. When his wife arrived in England, she sent him a telegram, which I guess was like the 1800s version of a text message. Took a while to get there. I don't really know how telegrams worked. But anyway, she sent this message and it said, saved alone, what shall I do? Spafford went to join her. He got on a ship, and when they were passing over where his daughters had drowned, the captain told him this is where it happened. And the story goes that on that journey, he penned the song, It Is Well With My Soul. Which the first verse of that one goes, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. When you pass through the river, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. I believe that when we learn to love God as God has loved us, when we learn to center our lives on the Lamb who was slain, that we will be put on this path to be shaped into people who can stand in the midst of any storm, who can survive when the waters of chaos press in upon us. Because I hear that story of that man losing his four daughters, how do you keep going? He would say, you only keep going if when you're passing through the waters, you look to the God who can bring you through. So I want to look at then three what I hope are practical things we can do as people who most of us, I believe, want to worship. We understand that we all worship something, but obviously we're all also pulled different directions by other and gods and lesser goods and things that want our allegiance. So what are a few ways that we can worship? Well, the first one I thought of is, what if we made an effort to come to church early? That's radical, I know. Come to church early and intentionally. What if we all made the commitment to get here at, like, I don't know, 9:45, get our coffee, chat with our friends, and be here intentionally so we can give our whole heart and mind to worship? Now, I know this is not easy. Like, I don't do this on a regular basis. I'm not standing up here saying, like, I'm sitting here early and, like, judging everybody. Like, I'm not someone who does this successfully on a regular basis. I know this is not easy. I understand. But I also know that we're all habitual people. Our internal clock, our Sunday habits, daily habits may just be show up at church at 10 o'clock, 10:05, whatever it is. And I'm simply throwing out there the idea, what if we made an effort to change those habits so that our habit was to become getting to church at 9:45? What if our Sunday morning habit, we took time, whether it's in this room before the service starts, at home before we come, to take a few moments to pray and to think and to prepare ourselves for worship? Plus, it'd be pretty funny if the worship team came up to sing and the room was full and they all, like, looked at their watches and thought they were late. So I think that'd be cool too. But again, I think that if we want to put ourselves in a place where our worship can transform us, then perhaps one practical application could be putting ourselves in this room to pray and sing together early is a good start. Another idea would be to consider what I have here, fixed hour prayer. We've talked a lot, if you've been around Koinos, we talk a lot about praying as an important practice. And what I mean by, I have there, set reminders to pray and worship daily. Again, we're all habitual people. I wake up in the morning, I get my coffee and my breakfast, I check the news on my phone. We get in our cars to drive to work, we listen to sports radio or a podcast or whatever. Like, we have our daily habits, and that's just who we are as humans. I'm just throwing out there the idea, what if we made a conscious effort to include in those daily habits reminders to pray? For the last few years, I've actually found a lot of help and depth in using prayer books, because I know I'm someone that if I have with the best intentions, I want to pray, but my mind wanders. So I sit there and I'm like, okay, God, I'm going to pray now. And then my mind wanders to, I don't know, the World Cup or the last movie I saw or whatever it might be. So I learned that historically Christians have actually had books of, like, prayers that they read, and I can focus on that better. So I purchased a couple of these books, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to read the morning prayer, and then I'm going to read a lunchtime prayer, and I'm going to read a prayer at dinner and before I go to bed. And what happened pretty much every day was I would read the morning one and then forget about it until the next day. So as I was preparing for this service this morning, I was trying to think of, because I was renewed in my kind of like, I want to take time out of each day to pray. What can I do? And I started doing a little searching, and I discovered there's a couple apps on our phones that we can use to remind us to pray. So I couldn't stand up here and say, throw your phone and, you know, keep it away from you, turn it off, and focus on God. But again, I'm not going to do that. Like, that's, we don't live in that world anymore. It's not a possibility. So what if instead of that, we utilized our phones in a positive way? So I can talk, if this is something interesting to you, I found a couple apps. One is the Book of Common Prayer, which is was put together by a couple people. And again, you open this app and there's morning prayer, midday prayer, evening prayer. So wherever I am, if I want to pray, I open it up, I read in there. The My Daily Office one at the bottom is a very similar one. And then I found this thing called Echo Prayer and another one called Prayer Prompter. I haven't used those as much. But for the one, I set reminders in my phone. So around 12:30, my phone goes ding. And I look at it, I'm like, oh, I should pray now. Maybe that's something that would help you. I think it's something that could help me. Because again, I look at my phone a lot during the day. But what if instead of around lunchtime, getting my phone out, seeing what people on Twitter are mad about, what if instead of doing that, I got my phone out and read a prayer? The third thing that goes along with that is, what if we memorized some scripture? Because once again, throughout our weeks, we're faced with lots of things that demand our ultimate allegiance and worship. We're faced with storms that threaten to overturn us, that press in upon us, the chaos pushes against us. And if our worship is just here and we don't take that with us, I think we're in a little trouble. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to memorize scriptures in Sunday school, and my daughter actually went to a vacation Bible school at a church near our house, and the scripture they learned was Isaiah 43:2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. And she memorized it. And when I was tasked with talking about worship and I was thinking about it, I was like, that's a pretty cool verse. Maybe I've said it enough that you haven't memorized already. I don't know. That was kind of the goal. But when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. I know memorizing verses is hard. I know as I get older, my mind, you know, start to forget things. And it's not easy like when you're kids. So again, this is not something that's easy. I'm not saying like go home and memorize verses and it's going to be no problem. But at the same time, I know that I can memorize songs pretty quickly when I hear them. They get stuck in my head. I can sing and you don't want me to do that. But maybe we don't give ourselves enough credit. And maybe if we start to memorize some of these scriptures, and Isaiah 43:2 is a great one to start with, I think. I could suggest others. Maybe you could think of others on your own. But that way, when we go through our weeks, and when those, again, the waters of chaos rise, and we're tempted to respond in anger or fear or gossip or whatever, just feelings come up, what if we had a couple encouraging scriptures that we could draw upon to recenter our lives on worship of the Lamb? In the end, when the waters of chaos press in upon us, we all worship something. We all look to something for help. One thing will always be there, no matter what. When you pass through the waters, God will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, the Lamb of God, Jesus, will keep you safe, and the rivers will not sweep over you. When life falls apart, what are we orienting our lives around? We're going to take a moment to dialogue, if anyone wants to. That's something we often do here if you're new at Koinos. We often have a time after the teaching for questions or comments, disagreements, or if there's something you were like, you missed this one thing, you could have gone, you know, throw a hand up, and I believe Tim has a mic, and you can ask away.
Hello.
Ooh.
Sorry about that.
No, it's good.
I always do that. I taught at a Quaker Friends school. It was a boarding school. And probably the most interesting part of that experience was Sundays and during the week, they did a Quaker meeting for worship. And their perspective on worship, like, if you want to learn more about worship, go read about Quaker Meeting for Worship.
Right.
It's a totally different experience. That is what they do for church. They just go, and the whole idea is you sit quietly for 45 minutes or an hour, and if you have a Bible, you can read, think about whatever you want, but you just sit quietly. If you're so moved, you stand up, you say something. Maybe somebody else will stand up and say something in response to that, or it's not necessarily a dialogue, it's just,
right,
you're just there. And what I took away from that was worship is more about time and focus. So, you know, I think pop culture gives you the idea that worship is kneeling down in front of a 20-foot idol and,
right,
you know, om and that kind of thing. My perspective is worship is you set aside time, whatever you have put time and focus your attention on, that's kind of what you're worshiping. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, worshiping God or Jesus. If you're spending time with your kids and focusing on that, you are worshiping your kids and family and things like that.
Sure.
So sort of that broader perspective of worship. And so anybody can be doing it at any time, right, but that's the key. Like, and you've touched on that, and what you worship is sort of what you are, what you embody. It's about time and focus, and from my perspective.
No, that's brilliant. I definitely agree. I mean, we could do an entire weeks on worship. There's so many different directions when I was starting to think about this to go, and I know I've definitely, that's something I want more of in my life. And I don't know if it's just because I have little kids, but just the idea of sitting in silence for 30 minutes is like, yes. So I think, yeah, thank you. Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing. That's great.
I don't usually get to do this. It's kind of fun. I'm just sitting here. So I'm a huge believer that worship is your entire life, right? And that all that you do should be pointing others towards God. And so with that being said, what is the value of Sunday morning? You know, why should we show up early? Why should we engage in the worship service?
That is a very good question. So, yes, well, I think Tim touched on, I think we did community a couple weeks ago. So I think it's one of those things that just the recognition that all of these different practices that we're talking about kind of lock together in some way. So yeah, like, does this mean I can sit at home by myself and sing songs or whatever, and is that a substitute? Well, no, I think because what we get here this morning is the community aspect. I would say a lot of the things we do on a Sunday morning are things that we also do throughout the week, but we're doing them together. I can sing songs in my car. I can give money. I can study the Bible. But what does it look like to sit around a small group or hear from someone like Tim? So I definitely think there's value in, and also I think just knowing that we are the kind of people, I am the kind of person at least, who left to myself is going to start to think a lot of wacky things. I think there's also value in like that question, am I truly worshiping the Lamb that was revealed in Jesus, God on the throne? Or am I starting to let that worship be influenced by, you know, the country I happen to live in, the career I have, the way I spend my money, Netflix, like all these things that are also kind of demanding worship? I think coming together in some sort of more formal setting kind of just, again, helps us recenter and refocus our worship so that throughout the week it is not just good for us, but it's also targeted towards something that's bigger than just us. I think there's value even what Chris mentioned about recognizing the Christians worship on Sunday morning in a lot of different ways. It's bigger than just me. It's bigger than what I happen to like. Again, if I was the sort of person that was based on what I wanted, we might just sit here for 45 minutes. Like, I'm not someone that's like, yes, let's sing a bunch of songs, you know? And I've been to worship services where they're like, they sing for an hour. So I think it's kind of getting out of it's all about me mode and recognizing that, like, hopefully here we're learning that we all like different things. Maybe we all have different aspects of worship that we especially resonate with. But it's not just about me. Consumerism is about me. Worship, I think, in a bigger picture is about all of us together being shaped towards a common goal. So, one more maybe?
Just to jump off of that comment, since nobody else was going to say anything, I wanted to point out, Phil and Leanne Wickline, who used to go here years ago, when they moved back to Virginia at one point, they went to a church that would wave flags during singing. Nice. To me, that was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen, and I've even seen churches that like did speaking in tongues and stuff. I thought the flag waving didn't mean anything.
Sure.
but it meant something to those people waving the flag. So,
great. Thanks for sharing. Awesome. And I pray, Lord, that we would be honest with ourselves as we go throughout our daily lives. I pray that you would make us into people who desire to worship you, and that we would include practices in our lives, starting with the practice of coming here on Sunday and singing and listening and giving together, and on into everything else we do, that we would continually reorient our lives around you. And I pray that through that you would change us, that as you meet us, you would change us into the people that we were created to be. It's in Jesus' name we pray.